Game On 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green. It's Monday the 12th of July. Coming up on Game On tonight, we look back at Italy's historic victory in London as football went to Rome.
Well, the reality here is, though, Bukayo Saka has got a pick to take. If he gets it, it goes to sudden death. If he misses, Italy are champions. And Donnarumma wins the title for Italy. And after 53 years, they're champions of Europe again.
Well, Derry possibly handed victory to Donegal at the weekend, but either way, it's Donegal that went through, so we'll ask Brendan Niveni how far he thinks they can go now.
It was a real Ulster Championship affair. Went right down to the wire and, you know, brilliant score from Patrick to win the game. But it was a real nip-and-tuck game.
Niall Moran runs the rule over today's hurling qualifier draw as rivals Brian Lohan and Davy Fitz go head-to-head in Thurles this Saturday.
Comes out to Lee Chin, over the shoulder from Chin, and Wexford lead in this game now by 1 point.
Novak Djokovic and Ashley Barty dominated in Wimbledon at the weekend. Conor Nyland will join us to have a look back at an epic couple of finals.
Championship point on a second serve. Backhand reply by Pliskova. Slice backhand from Barty. Pliskova hits the forehand. Barty hits the forehand. Backhand from Pliskova into the net. Ash Barty realises a childhood dream on centre court. She's a Wimbledon champion.
Now, if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
So here we are, Ruby, after a month of magnificent football. Italy are the European champions, defeating England at Wembley last night. How are you feeling after it?
How am I feeling after it? I must say I read the back of yesterday morning's Sunday Independent and I read Eamon Sweeney's article, and when I saw Chiellini pulling back Saka at the end of full time, I was thinking he nailed it in his column. Obi-Wan Chiellini. What did I think? England started the best, or Italy then dominated? I don't know. It was a great match. It wasn't a great match to watch. I guess I felt that when England were one up, time was going really quickly. And then when Italy equalised, time seemed to slow down. So that probably told me that I wanted Italy to win.
Well, we are joined on the line by Alan Cawley and Fergal Brennan. And Alan Cawley did indeed believe that football was coming home. But Alan, you were wrong.
I was, Marie. I was, to be fair. Sorry.
Oh, we've lost Alan. Fergal was also on with us on Friday. And Fergal, you weren't as convinced.
No, I don't take any pride necessarily in Alan getting his call wrong, but I just think, as was proven in the final, the kind of small little differences, the small little battles, one-on-one mental battles, and then obviously the kind of ultimate mental barrier to get over, which is penalties, Italy proved to have that bit of an edge.
Yeah, I think Ruby was right as well. Like, England started so quickly out of the blocks that I think everybody was in shock, including the Italians, because as we've seen, they don't fall behind in games. It was 17 matches since they'd last fallen behind, so it just took them a while to almost steady themselves and remember what they were able to do and what they were capable of.
Yeah, I think, again, it comes back to this idea of reaction to situations. Italy have a team that's full of major title winners. They've won domestic trophies, international trophies, and England just don't have that. That's just a fact of the situation. Fantastic tournament as England have had. They just don't have that. And that, unfortunately, sounds very, very basic and straightforward, but that is the situation in these types of games, and that's what decided it for Italy.
Fergal, when you watched that match last night, England started so brightly. Trippier's cross to Luke Shaw to score, the pace they were playing at, they were opening the Italians up at will. Is there any chance England ran themselves into the ground in the first 30 minutes?
Potentially. What I think arguably happened is they showed the hand too early. Finals are not won in the first 10, 15, or even half an hour. They're won second half, extra time, penalties, and that was the difference between the two teams. Again, I keep kind of going back to the same point, but it rings true. England were really good and on the front foot. The crowd were really passionate and right behind them. But ultimately, Italy slowed the pace of the game down, started to get their key players on the ball, and that that decided it for them.
Well, Alan Cawley is back. Alan, I know you don't like being wrong, but you didn't have to hang up on us.
Marie, I'd never hang up on you, but yeah, I was wrong, obviously, in terms of the outcome, and it's been quite close. England, as we all know, as we've outlined throughout the last few weeks, got themselves into a brilliant position, probably the best position they'll ever have of winning a major trophy, and going into the game against Italy, who probably favourites, rightly favourites as well, but even though there wasn't much between the teams, and to get themselves a goal up and obviously looking like they were going to go on and win it, and then for it all to come undone for them and losing out in a penalty shootout. So it was fairly close, but I think they've only themselves to blame, really, Marie, when you look back at the game. And I just wonder psychologically, when you look at it, did they score too early? Because we obviously knew the pressure that they were under, and up to now they've probably handled the pressure quite well. Southgate, as we've complimented him for the last number of weeks on how well he's deflected the pressure away from the players as well, and the media scrutiny, and up to now they have handled it really well. But I just wonder, scoring so early in the game and the weight of expectation and pressure that was always going to build and mount on them, and not getting that second goal when they were having their purple period, I suppose, in the first 20 minutes, half an hour, Italy were always going to come back into the game. And they were a bit safe as well, Marie. I know Southgate, he's got all the calls right up to now, and he has been quite conservative, but I've liked his management so far. But I just felt he was a little bit too safe then again last night, even with substitutions and extra time. I felt he could have maybe have gone for it a little bit more. It was almost like they were accepting penalties. And once it comes down to penalties, I think he got it wrong in his decisions as well on the penalty takers. And I know he said this has been planned out during the week, but there's no way in a million years you'd have a 19-year-old taking your fifth penalty, or bringing on two lads with 30 seconds to go, or whatever it was, 90 seconds to go, Sancho and Rashford, and let them take a penalty. So I think that's an area where he definitely reflected, think maybe he got it wrong.
But that's a penalty shootout, Alan, where anything can happen. Rashford's ball is 3 yards to the right inside the post. Not 3 yards, 3 centimetres to the right and inside the post, and it's a different result. But look back at the other parts of the game. He started to play not to lose from half time, went from a back three to a back five, and just gave all the impetus to Italy.
Yeah, and that's where I'd be critical of him, Ruby. And I've stuck up for him all along, Southgate, and I think he's done really, really well. And his management, all the calls, to be fair, even the conservative calls, he has got right up to now. But I would agree totally with you in terms of looking at that at half-time, thinking we're playing now not to lose, where I think he has the weapons in his armoury in terms of the players that he had, not just even on the pitch as in the first 11, but what he has to bring off the bench to maybe go and kill the game at that stage. But I go back to scoring so early in the game, and it's a psychological thing, and we see it so often in sport as well. It's almost as if to have something to hold on to, and we don't want to lose it. But straight away, as you say, you're giving the impetus to the opposition, and Italy, fighting for their lives, were always going to come back into the game, and they have quality themselves, particularly that midfield area. Once they got the foothold in the game, got the equaliser, if anything, they looked like they were going to maybe go on and win it. So I just think maybe it's come back to bite him, Southgate, in terms of how conservative he's been throughout the tournament. He got away with it up to now. But when you're in that position to go and win the tournament, I think you should go all out and go and try and win it. And maybe it just caught up on him last night, because he certainly looked back on that with regret. As I said, it's probably the best chance, the best opportunity that he may ever have to win a major trophy as well as a manager with England. And to leave it behind him in the manner that they did, and you're right in terms of the stuff going on in the game, but I still look back at the penalties as well. I know the Rashford one, I've no problem with him taking penalties. He takes them at Man United, but I just can't understand the decision with Sancho and Saka as well taking the penalty, particularly Saka at the end. And I won't blame the young fella at all, but I think there's senior players in that team that should have been taking penalties before him.
Well, Roy Keane did point the finger at a few, and so did Jose Mourinho. But Jack Grealish came out today and tweeted Fergal and said that he did want to take a penalty, and he didn't want anyone saying that he didn't. So you'd imagine that when you look at those senior players that are in there, I'm sure many of them did, but you just expect that Gareth Southgate has his plan and he decides who picks them.
Yeah, it's just such a strange scenario, particularly as Alan said with Saka, because you look at Rashford, he's probably second behind Bruno Fernandes as a penalty taker at Manchester United. Jadon Sancho is fairly used to taking penalties. I think he took 10 and scored 10 in the last season or season and a half. But the idea of Saka is such a strange one. I looked at some of the numbers before, and he's never taken a penalty in senior football. Obviously, he doesn't have that much experience at senior level as it is. And it is easy to point the finger at other players, Grealish or John Stones or Raheem Sterling, but actually, there's not that many regular penalty takers of the 11 players that were still left on the pitch. And Southgate said that in his post-match, that it was the best five of the players left on, and that was telling. He essentially hinted that there was two players that had come off for whatever reason that would have been on that list. I would say Kieran Trippier. He scored in the 2018 World Cup against Colombia in the shootout, and Jordan Henderson for me would have been one as well. I know he missed in the friendly in the build up to the tournament, but the entire reason for bringing Jordan Henderson was for these types of moments in the eyes of Southgate and in the eyes of England fans. We know he wasn't 100% fit before the tournament, but that experience, the standards that he demands from players, his hand would have shot up at the thought of taking a penalty. So him being subbed on and then subbed off when Rashford and Sancho came on, I find that very strange. By 115 minutes onwards, you know that it's 9 times out of 10 going to go to a penalty shootout. Why not take off someone that's definitely not going to take a penalty? Kyle Walker, John Stones, if they're definitely, definitely not going to take a penalty, leave Jordan Henderson on the pitch. I agree with Rashford and I do agree with Sancho. I just don't see the logic with Saka. And obviously in training, he's demonstrated that he can take a penalty and he does have a fantastic temperament and a brilliant technical ability. Some of these decisions just have to be taken out of players' hands. He's a young man, very confident. Of course he's going to say to the manager, yes, I'll take a penalty. He wants to seem brave. He wants to stand up. And you know, the margins are so thin. He smashes that past Donnarumma. He's the most successful, or certainly the most iconic moment in English football in half a decade. Obviously, it didn't play out that way. So there's a little bit of blame to be apportioned to the manager. I don't blame any player that steps up to take a penalty. But Henderson, for me, is the strange one because he's been subbed on to manage the situation and kind of direct the flow of the game, and then he gets subbed off when there's absolutely, you know, he's captain of Liverpool, he's won the Premier League, he's won the Champions League, he'd definitely take a penalty. He's the one that I don't understand why he was taken off.
But Alan, that's, and you're both questioning the same thing, you're questioning the Russian roulette at the very end, the penalty shootout. Why not question his decisions way before that? How did he leave Mason Mount on for so long when he was flat as a pancake? Sterling had disappeared out of the game. Harry Kane, I think he was on the pitch. I heard him getting mentioned there for plenty of the game. Should those guys not have been looked at and try and get energy into the team from shortly after half time?
Yeah, possibly, Ruby, and it's a fair point as well, because the one thing we said even in the preview and the build-up to the game on Friday night, and what I felt was a huge advantage to this England game, was the weapons that they possessed off the bench, and I thought that was going to be the difference in the game. That you're coming into the 65th, 70 minute. We saw it against Denmark, obviously, when he brings on Foden and Grealish and the energy and quality that they have, Sancho, whoever the case may be. But for whatever reason, he chose not to do that. And I just think, was he just playing it too safe at that stage? The game was obviously in the melting pot. None of the teams really looked like it. I heard your comments at the start. I didn't think it was a great game, Ruby, even though we've had a brilliant tournament. I didn't think it was a great game in itself, the actual final. And it was almost the two of them, once it went 1-1, were kind of settling for, as you said, playing not to kind of lose, and that made for kind of a drab affair in the end. But and that's when it comes down to, I suppose, the ballsier one, who wants to go for it, who wants to be brave, who wants to make the bold decision to actually go and win the match. And maybe that was the case with Southgate. He is quite conservative, as we've seen throughout the whole tournament. It wasn't just the case in the game last night, and maybe that's what caught up on him. I would agree with Fergal totally on the Henderson one as well. I'm a big fan of Henderson, a senior player, captain of Liverpool. He would have stepped up no problem. Why he took him off, or even you could look at it with the Saka one. Why was he going fifth if he's in the lineup and that was the best five you had? Maybe let him go first or second, because the game is not going to be decided on the first or second penalty. Mm-hmm. It was always going to be decided on the fifth. So maybe, I think Harry Maguire went second and Kane went first. I'd have Kane taking the fifth or even the third or fourth down the pecking order, but I'd never have Saka taking the fifth penalty with the pressure that was on the kid. And even Fergal mentioned that maybe he stepped up in training and he looked great scoring. You'll never replicate taking a penalty in training to the magnitude of what was at stake in Wembley last night, or in any big game, but let alone a European Championship final like that. You'll never replicate training to a match situation like that.
And Fergal, after the game, racism reared its ugly head. It's just awful to see the players getting abused for not winning a game or for missing a penalty, and so many people have had to come out today and just call for people to stop putting things up on social media. But at this stage, you'd have to think that it needs to go further than just the likes of William and Kate or the FA or big clubs coming out just asking to stop, that it needs to be, there needs to be more consequences.
There does, and it is obviously absolutely vile that it's still going on, and that, you know, within seconds, within minutes of the final whistle blowing and England losing, that these types of comments were being posted online and on social media accounts. And unfortunately, the argument continues to roll on, which is that social media companies, in particular Twitter and Facebook, are just not doing enough. I've heard a lot of people raise the example that if you put a highlights reel of a football match on Twitter, it's removed within minutes and your account could potentially be suspended, whereas we're seeing these abhorrent incidents relating to racism that are just not being dealt with nearly strictly enough. And I think Gino Wijnaldum mentioned it during the tournament, that if there was any instances of racism during the game, chanting or any crowd disturbance, that he'd have no hesitation in taking the Netherlands team off the pitch. And I think, unfortunately, we are heading in that direction where we're going to see that happen. We're probably going to see it happen more regularly in the next 12 or 18 months. And I genuinely think that's the only step that hasn't been taken yet that needs to, because at the moment, there's still not being enough done by the powers that be. We've seen the fines that have been handed out and the, quite frankly, pathetic punishments that have been handed to FAs that are then only really having a trickle-down effect to the individuals and the groups that are responsible for this type of thing. If racism is to be kicked out of football, it needs a universal effort right the way across the board, education within schools, education within communities. And only when we get to that sort of a situation will it be stamped out. But footballers themselves, within work, if you're speaking to footballers on a regular basis, they're sick of it. They're sick of every time they pick up the phone, the potential that they could just flick onto their social media account and see something truly horrendous and the effect it has on them and their families and their friends. It has to stop, but it has to stop from a universal approach right the way across the board, not a few £1,000 fine or, you know, partial closings of stadiums. There needs to be a widespread approach, and only when there is will this have any chance of stopping, because at the moment it's gone too far, but worryingly the measures that are in place are not nearly effective enough.
But Fergal, you look at what was going on yesterday in Leicester Square, the fans bulldozing their way into Wembley. I mean, the British government can't keep control of the fans. How do you expect the FA to control them?
I mean, I think particularly in terms of the incidents that happened in Leicester Square and then obviously close to Wembley Stadium, I think there's a misjudging of the situation in terms of the level of security that's placed on this. And there's been a lot of criticism levelled at Wembley and the stewards and the security staff. These are individuals that are on just over minimum wage and being put in very, very dangerous situations. The responsibility of security planning around a major event is the responsibility of the Metropolitan Police, stadium security at Wembley and the government. And there simply just hasn't been anything done. So that's what I said before. It's not a one system approach of the FA have to deal with it, or the police or the government, etc. They need to work together on this, and at the moment that just isn't happening. There's a lot of token gestures and a lot of kind of empty words that have been said towards these things, and the incidents that we saw in Leicester Square, these are the images and the videos that have dogged England fans for decades and decades and decades, and unfortunately we're seeing very little sign of it going away, because for every positive story that you see connected with the England football team and the players that have brought a lot of pride to any England fans that you do speak to, these pictures and these images ultimately rule the day, because England fans sometimes maybe get themselves into a false sense of security that they're, you know, consigned to the past. They're not. They were very much there, front and centre, for everybody to see yesterday. And in terms of the way that it's being dealt with, there needs to be a cross approach. You can't expect a security officer on £9 an hour to put his or her life in danger dealing with these types of situations. And that was exactly what happened yesterday. There was this blind hope that fans would police themselves, organise themselves and behave themselves, and you'd have to be incredibly naive to think that any of those things were ever going to happen based on the fan base that you're dealing with.
Yeah, and you'd have to think now their hopes of a World Cup in 2030 have been dealt a serious blow after those scenes were broadcast all around the world last night. Alan, we have to give Italy a bit more credit, I think, because we've spent so much time talking about England, but they were so impressive right from the start of the tournament. And I think particularly Mancini, when you think about where he started and Italy not qualifying for that World Cup in Russia to where he's got to now.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, Marie, and I'm glad you brought up that, because as you say, we've spent a lot of time discussing England. And understandably, because obviously we're so close to them, and there were a huge story in that, and obviously what they were looking to achieve. But Italy have been absolutely fantastic, and we mentioned it Friday night. If you go back to the very opening night of the tournament, they were so impressive. They kicked off the tournament in style, probably playing a style of football that you wouldn't necessarily associate with Italy over the last number of years. But since Mancini has come in, there's a dynamism about the team, there's an excitement about them. They played brilliant attack and football throughout games in the tournament, and of course they have a balance on the other side of that as well, Marie, in terms of the defensive side of things, and they pride themselves on defending. You look at Bonucci, Chiellini, we spoke about them so often. Chiellini, I think, did his cruciate in 2019 as well, and you look at him last night making overlapping runs.
He done some job on Saka last night, that's what he did.
He's phenomenal, Ruby, he really is. And that's what I say, like, you look at modern day football now and it's almost a case of defenders, their managers are more interested in defenders who can play football. But defending, you're there to defend and keep the ball out of the net, and that's what they do, and that's what they pride themselves on. If you can play football, that's a bonus on top of it, but they pride themselves on that. They've been absolutely brilliant. All the different units from a defensive side of things, they're so good. You look at them in the midfield area, I think Jorginho, I know he missed the penalty, but I think he's been brilliant in the tournament as well. Barella, the young lad that's at Inter Milan, absolutely brilliant. Insigne, Immobile. So he's done some job, Mancini, and he deserves huge amount of credit, not just in this tournament. I think they're unbeaten now, 34 games as well, so it's a remarkable run that they're on. And to crown it off winning the tournament last night, it was just fantastic for them, and particularly for Mancini.
But Alan, could they have finished with nine players? You had the tackle on Grealish that was over the top and straight onto his knee, and then you had Chiellini, basically he'd have got a red in rugby for a high tackle, let alone in soccer.
Yeah, and sure, that's what they do, Ruby, you know. And obviously the phrase is used, the dark arts as well. And
there's nothing dark art about that. The dark art is feigning an injury or rolling around. That was beyond the dark art. Now, that was just grabbing them, dragging them into the stand.
Yeah, and that's where obviously it comes back to the referee. But I think in terms of the dark art, there's gamesmanship that goes on as well. And that's something that may be going out of the game. But they're deadly at it and they're brilliant at it. And it can be a part of the game. Like, there's always arguments I'd have amongst people and friends about in terms of, is it win at all costs? They're there to win, and that's it. And whatever happens in that game, for them to win, they're going to do it. And you look at them last night, they obviously reaped the rewards of it now. And they're doing it for years and years and years, Ruby. It's all they know. Chiellini, particularly Bonucci, they're absolutely brilliant. The longevity they've had in their career, it's something they've been brought up with. It's kind of an Italian culture thing. And I don't think it's going to change. And I think it's a good thing for football that it doesn't change, because maybe it opens people's eyes as well to realise there's other parts of the game. It's not just all about, I suppose, the modern day football that we see in the ticky tacky football. There's other ways to win matches, and they have a brilliant balance in how to go about it, attacking wise and also defensively.
Yeah, and I loved their passion and their personalities as well. A lot of people fell in love with Italian football over the last few weeks. And Fergal, before we finish up, we have to mention Lionel Messi, because we talked about him on Friday and his long wait for a major trophy. Well, it is over now, because Argentina beat Brazil to win the Copa America final.
Yeah, and the final itself, I think he's ran his legs into the ground on the back of a really long and difficult season with Barcelona. But it's just a mark of how brilliant he is that, despite not having an incredible game in the final, he got player of the tournament, top goal scorer, top assister, and you just saw the scenes at full time. And the last 10 minutes was like a war. The amount of yellow cards that were getting thrown around, and we talk about dark arts, that final was on another level in terms of that. But every single player, the second the final whistle was blown at the Maracanã, just ran over to him. They were immediately on top of him, hugging him, celebrating it, and it just means absolutely so much to him. And when you speak to people that work quite regularly within Spanish football, that there is this assumption that because he's been in Spain for so long, that his love and his commitment for Argentina would be a bit diluted. That just isn't the case. That just isn't the case at all. It's the country that he grew up in, where he learned to play football, where he went to school in, and all of his family are from, and it still means absolutely everything to him. So it's nice to see a huge fairy tale every now and in football come true. But on Chiellini, I'd have to say I do agree with Ruby. There's dark arts and there's dangerous play. I think if that was 5 yards a bit more centrally and he had a bit more of a direct run on goal, he'd have been sent off, and quite rightly so. He could have really injured Saka. There is a difference between little bits of gamesmanship and that type of stuff. And he knew exactly what he was doing. Bonucci even gave him a little look afterwards to say, you're a lucky boy there, that he wasn't closer to goal. But these decisions, if they go in your favour, if you look at it from an Italian perspective, all add up to the greater good in the eyes of the Italy fans, which is them beating England and winning the European Championships.
It surely was. Fergal Brennan, thanks so much for taking our call. Alan, I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. We're going to take a quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Green Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, football, Gaelic football really needed a decent game, and Donegal and Derry served that up this weekend. Brendan Devaney, former Donegal player, is with us. Brendan, I think everybody was really happy that it was a really competitive fixture between Donegal and Derry.
Yeah, certainly, Marie, and as we're saying, the haves and the have-nots, some teams are getting blown away. It's horrible to see. It's happening everywhere. You know, Ulster was probably the last province where there seemed to be not that level between so many teams. There's at least four, now for me, five teams that are quite close to each other, and we're waiting for a good game even in Ulster, and that certainly was delivered yesterday. It was age of the seat stuff, and from a Donegal perspective, it was stomach-churning. It's a while since I've been in a championship game that's like that, and you'd have to say for Rory Gallagher and his team, you know, if that was a cloak and dagger move in terms of selling us a league form and a league way of playing and then completely changing it in terms of championship. Derry came with a game plan, and listen, it should have delivered. Me, Donegal were so lucky to win that match yesterday. So many question marks for Derry, why they didn't come away with the victory.
Why they didn't come away, I probably just didn't take their chances. It's as simple as that, I'd have said. But what about for Donegal, Brendan? What are they going to have to do? Where are they going to have to improve? Because as you said, Derry should have won, so therefore Donegal were second best.
Yeah, if you look back to last year, I suppose, you know, Derry hammered Armagh, came in a wee bit cold and not on it against Cavan, and were beat. Something very similar yesterday, beat down, so handy, had it their own way, were cruising, were this, were that. And you've just seen wee glimpses of Donegal this last few years. They're very good at certain things, and defensively not good at others. So a couple of young cornerbacks, fullbacks coming through, you've had horrific injuries, you know, the likes of Gillespie there from Gidor, double cruciate, and we Morrison as well, Connor Morrison. Those types of players Donegal were really clinging on to in terms of fulfilling the likes of the Neil McGee role. So you've seen yesterday, we just don't have man-to-man markers. I mean, the likes of Owen McHugh dropping in around. I think tactically for Donegal yesterday, once Derry went full 15 inside the 45, Donegal had to match them. They didn't do that, and that's what left them open, and that's why Derry had so many chances. They had three great goal chances in the game, possibly a penalty as well. At the other end of the pitch, Donegal never really got near the Derry goal. But listen, Donegal just don't seem to be, you know, they have that fighting instinct. We've seen it in a few matches. They've seen it against Armagh, the league, and Monaghan when they were looked dead and buried, and they keep coming back. So that is in them. I mean, it's certainly putting pressure on all those fans watching, but they never say die. And listen, as the lads were saying, I think about four players played well for Donegal yesterday. You know, you talk about Patton, McGonigal, Langan, Niall O'Donnell. I would say they were the four players that really stood up for Donegal. Normally you would have maybe four players that don't play well. So I think for Donegal can only be improvement. And the way Tyrone, I was up in Healy Park on Saturday night, the way they dispatched Cavan, listen, Donegal's going to have to do an unbelievable amount of improvement if they're going to beat Tyrone.
Would you think you have your Donegal jersey on, you know, when you say that was possibly a penalty that Derry should have had?
You know, seeing real time, it looked like he went down a bit easy. I mean, you see it in slow motion, it looks like a definite penalty. It's a hard call. I think, you know, you're just talking soccer before. The last thing in GAA anybody wants is to give anything soft. But listen, it definitely was a case. Looking back at it now, it was a 50-50. Should Derry have got a goal in that game, it would have been such a platform. That said, Donegal were four down in the second half and still managed to come back. But as I say, Rory Gallagher, listen, some teams have ingredients. You look at Derry, listen, they were playing Leitrim the year before last. Look at the hammer Leitrim got yesterday. The difference is in the GAA, certain counties have the ingredients to come back up and to get back into the top level. Armagh, as we see, have come back into Division 1. Derry have unbelievable schools, football, underage teams always performing, brilliant club teams. They have the ingredients to come back. So there's no doubt, and that was a statement from Derry yesterday, that they're going to come back and be an Ulster contender. And for Donegal, I suppose they want to get their title back. You know, they were going for three in a row last year until they were caught. And still, for me, you know, on their day, I think are still the team to beat in Ulster. And listen, it's a mouthwatering clash. The two semi-finals, I think, are going to be brilliant games coming here in Ulster.
We're taking 12 minutes to score for Donegal. Would that bother you, starting that slow?
See the blanket defence, Ruby, that rigid blanket defence. Don't forget, you've players in there of the class of Chrissy McCaig and Brendan Rodgers. I mean, you had an unbelievable game from Patrick Cassidy in there. They bought into it, and this is the thing about Rory Gallagher and about how he did with Fermanagh. If you haven't had success, he is going to demand that here is the pathway to success, and you're going to have to be rigid on what he's telling you. So they were coached to an inch of their lives, and Derry bought into a system. They didn't come to give Donegal a game yesterday. They come to win the match, and everybody was taken aback, and Donegal were as well, because Derry hadn't played yet in the league. So I think that you'd have to hand it to Derry in terms of coming with that tactic that they did. But see, in terms of, I know there's some criticism of McBurdy and Jamie Brennan, different people. I don't care what forward you are. If you have 15 inside, and we've seen the best forwards in Ireland struggle against rigid defences. We've seen Donegal snuff out all the top forwards in Ireland by putting the whole team back inside. That's what Derry did yesterday. They did it. It's not nice to see. But in Donegal not mirroring them, they left themselves a bit open. And that's what I think led to Derry having that performance where they could have and should have won the match.
Yeah, well, you could tell their level of fitness as well were really good. And then they had 13 from play, 9 different scorers, and they got their matchups right as well. But one player that's worth looking at is Michael Murphy, as always. And you mentioned the Tyrone match. How do you manage the situation now with him, just given how important he is, and also the fact that he just doesn't seem right?
Yeah, well, I suppose he missed those weeks, and no matter what, you know, he's a big frame of a man. He's, you know, you talk about miles on the clock. He has played some football for Donegal and club and colleges and everything now over the years. So the body can only take so much. So we got to use Michael in the right ways, and I think that's vital, Emery, where we play him and how he's moving. But it was just interesting yesterday. As soon as he came on, the Derry lads gave him serious attention, and that led to a soft free. And you think about the small things in the game. Donegal won the game by a point. And while the ref was watching at that attention, as Murphy came out, it wasn't really a foul for me. But because of the attention he was getting previous to that, he gets the free and Donegal get a vital score. I think that was, we were 4 down, we just got one. That was the second one. They bring us within 2. So for Michael, where do we play him and what can we do? As long as his hamstring holds up, Emery, we're all praying it does, because his influence yesterday coming off, because McBurdy had a free from the right-hand side or from the left-hand side, a right foot of kick in the first half and missed it. So Michael comes on, kicks that one, and he had a fairly awkward one after that, pressure free, he nails it over the bar, and that is the difference that Michael brings. He brought all the attention of Derry to him, and listen, he's absolutely key. He's a key man for Donegal, so we're going to have to nurse him this whole week and maybe put him into the Atlantic a bit there to get this hammer healed up.
You mentioned the cornerbacks in Donegal and the fact that they were leaking goal chances. And then you look at Tyrone, who beat Cavan 1-8 to 13 points, 118. 118 is a big score. And look, we know the threats that they have up front and also the type of football that the management are trying to play. And we saw a lot more of that over the weekend. How are Donegal going to be able to manage Tyrone, just given what we saw at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing. It's a bit like reading Andy Derry's league form and then saying, how did that happen? Because Cavan should have beaten Derry in the league. And I'm watching Tyrone dismantle Cavan. So I'm thinking, how good are Derry? But yet that's a completely different animal that came. And when Donegal play Tyrone, everything changes. It changes a game in terms of, this will be a completely different match. And Donegal just have this thing over Tyrone at the minute. So it's a massive game for Tyrone. They beat them twice last year. Beat them in the league earlier. It was only by 2 points up in Healy Park. But Donegal controlled the match. I think the big warning sign for Donegal was McCurry's form. Unbelievable. One of the best performances I've seen from a forward. 10 points and some absolutely unreal ones on it. McShane came off the bench. Mark Bradley comes off the bench. Frank Burns. You know, there was some brilliant performance. Tiernan McCann as well. And you just think that bench that they have now is going to be serious versus what Donegal have. So, you know, Tyrone, Brewster Park, I think this is the game. This is the game that's going to define them, because Donegal have bossed them the last few years. So, as I was saying, it's going to be mouthwatering. I think it'll, but like Sunday's game, it'll come right down the wire.
So Donegal and Tyrone is going to shape Ulster football. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, well, listen, the
winner takes all sort of a thing.
Well, yeah, well, we've seen some great stuff from Monaghan. You know, Armagh, again, the hunger is back with them. I was really impressed with Armagh and Monaghan, the two games that they played Donegal. So I think there's not a lot between those four teams in Ulster, Ruby, you know, and I think they're a long way off, like the main two. I mean, it's no coincidence that Dublin and Kerry shared the league this year. I think there's some ways ahead of the rest. You know, whatever comes out of Connacht as well, of course, between Galway and Mayo. Listen, so we can never write off the Mayo boys, but I think the four in Ulster, you know, any of them don't fear each other, and it'll come down to a very tight game between the two in the semi final and the two in the final. But as least as we started the show off with, there'll be no hammerings. Well, unless we hammer Tyrone on Sunday, which wouldn't bother me too much, to be honest.
Yeah, you're going to have to figure out a way of marking Darren McCurry. You won't be hammering Tyrone. When you watch the Munster,
there's quite a few of them.
Yeah, when you watch the Munster matches at the weekend, Kerry obviously were much too good for Tipperary on the day. Cork ran out good winners over Limerick, but to my untrained GAI, Cork have a long way to go to catch up to Kerry.
Yeah, listen, Kerry last year, that sting, you talk about a sting, they've come out and absolutely pulverised teams in the league, you know, including giving Galway an awful hammering, which left Rockburg Joyce back and put Galway back. I mean, we delve into the league maybe a bit too much at times because it looks like panic stations, but after Tyrone shipped 6-15 against them, I mean, an absolutely ridiculous scoreline for any teams that are supposed to be aspiring to play each other. So this Kerry machine, I think Dublin has forced Kerry to really up their game and to search every avenue they have, because they were the kingpins. Kerry were always the kingpins. Dublin have very much taken that crown now. So Dublin have forced Kerry to get better and better. And meanwhile, as I say, the Ulster teams are scrapping. Mayo, you know, / Galway are scrapping to try and catch up to that race. But certainly, yeah, I mean, Kerry have their eyes on one thing. That's an All-Ireland final against Dublin. And that's the way the season is shaping up.
I think Paddy Clifford is that other level that you're talking about, the way he's able to link that whole forward line together, the amount of possessions that he has, and that telepathic way he has of playing with his brother. But let's look at Mayo and Leitrim now. Mayo absolutely hammered them. I was at it. Look, it was very hard to take anything away from it. It was a complete mismatch. But Mayo are going to be playing Galway in a couple of weeks' time, a much bigger test. And you nearly worry that they'll be almost undercooked when you think they've come from playing four games in Division 2 of the league, and then very, very routine wins over Sligo and Leitrim.
Yeah, it just be Mayo in the championship. Whenever it comes up, you know, they're going to do their best, and they're going to become a different side. And, you know, they obviously bossed Connacht for years there, you know, with 4 and 5 in a row. Galway come back into it then, and you just look at Pádraig Joyce now and the style of play, and, you know, they did their job against Roscommon. Going into Mayo now, that's still a toss of a coin, you know, injury problems in Mayo, and everyone now is tightening up with injuries. And listen, what's going to come out of Connacht? Is it going to be good enough to challenge the best? Is it going to be good enough to challenge the Dubs? Obviously, that's the path that they're on, and so far everyone keeps coming up short. Mind you, what we've seen of the Dubs, could this be the year there's a small chink of light there? Maybe they've got fed up taking this title, Maria, and give the rest of us a chance.
Well, I very much doubt that, but who knows, Brendan? It's your son's birthday. What's his name?
His name is Sennan.
Well, happy and, birthday,
Sennan. What age is he?
Yeah, we're all barbecuing here. I doubt there'll be anything left for me now. Hey, they're vultures in the Venice.
You're not on burger duty then, no?
I just did it before I come up back, say, Marie. So, you know yourself, with these kids' birthday parties, they tend up being adults' birthday parties, but
well,
we kind of take
say
over.
Any excuse at all. Brendan, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you
no
soon.
No problem.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So earlier today, the GAA All-Ireland Senior Hurling Qualifiers draw were made, and Cork and Galway got a bye into round two. Waterford drew Laois, but Clare drew Wexford. Davy Fitz managing Wexford, going taking on Clare, and it's just going to be fantastic. Niall Moran's on the line. Niall, this is trench warfare.
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day anyway, Ruby. Again, we see Clare and Wexford. At this stage, I think everyone needs to, Davy and Brian just have their own separate arm wrestle, best of three, and let that decide us, because
well, just go out on the pitch before the kick-off and just have one slap at each other, let it all be done and dusted, no?
Yeah, I think, look, in fairness, that's the popular narrative amongst us bystanders, but look, I'm sure that's for both of those managers. Do you know what I mean? Part of me thinks that they might have actually wanted to avoid each other. I think they could do maybe without having to go through this whole narrative again. They've been over and back through it, but I suppose more importantly for Davy, he might represent his last stand. It could be Lohan's final parting shot, like to knock him out of the championship, maybe end his Wexford tenure. So I know that'll be at the back of his head. But really, I suppose when you look over the last 10 years, like, you've had a lot of fascinating contests between like so Tip Kilkenny, you've had Cork Waterford, but I suppose going back as far as 13, Clare and Wexford, they've been intertwined from, do you know what I mean, 13, 14, that huge games this year and last year, huge games. So yeah, there'll be nothing between them. They've learned enough about each other, and yeah, it'll be interesting, Thurles.
That's the thing, Niall. It is an absolutely massive game because of everything that Clare have been through this year. Is the up and down, the emotional roller coaster, arguably the injustice of last week, and for Davy as well, because we weren't sure whether he was going to go back this year, and he did. And then again, there's just so many ups and downs, and both of them will really want to win it. The two teams have put in a huge amount of work, and it's winner takes all.
Yeah, it is winner takes all. Look, as I said, maybe the future of that Wexford group might be dependent on it. Clare less so, because they're probably a team that are earlier in their lifespan. But look, it's probably going to come down. Last year they played in Port Leash, and like, we had Tony Kelly scored 115 from play. Ultimately, that was the difference between the two sides. When it came to the league game this year, Clare had him rattled. They had him on the rack, and Wexford hit him for 2 goals in the last 10 minutes. So, but again, on that occasion, Tony Kelly went off after about a half an hour. So, look, I think really it's a testament to Davy at this stage. Surely he has some plan up his sleeve for Tony Kelly. I think he might have taken a leaf out of Liam Sheedy's book with that man-marking job that Cathal Barrett did. So, look, that might ultimately be the grain of rice that tips the weighing scales, like, you know. So, yeah, it's going to be a very, very interesting game. A part of me would have liked to see maybe Wexford Waterford just to freshen it up in the southeast. But, yeah, it's very interesting, and a very interesting game on the other side as well, Leash and Waterford.
Yeah, Leash and Waterford. Sorry, Ruby.
Sorry, Marie. Going, Leash obviously got the better of Antrim yesterday afternoon. Waterford, they look at that as the softest draw in here, will they?
Yeah, it's the draw they would have wanted. So you'd be condescending to say otherwise. But I suppose the one thing about it is Leash found a little bit of form. Like, Leash have very, very good hurlers. John, they have a passionate man and Cheddar over them. It's just that, look, they had a lot of injuries maybe throughout the year. Results kind of went against them. But like, they'll be thrilled with that win over Antrim. They have a free shot at it on Saturday, bearing in mind the sit of a relegation game to play in the league. But for Waterford, like, really, if they have credentials, they have to be building up the momentum. They have to start going through the gears. And I suppose, look, it is going to be a long route through the qualifiers. They're going to be out the next 4 weeks in a row. And I suppose going back to, I suppose most inter-county players will tell you they don't want to be in the Gawler races on the Monday, the Gawler races, because if you're there that night, you know you're under pressure. You have to be knocked out early in the championship.
Well, if they're there this year, there's some geniuses.
Jesus, yeah, the hole in the wall on the Monday was off in the graveyard of an average county teams.
If they can get in there on the Monday night this year, they're going well. They'll be in there and they're on their own by the sounds of it.
Yeah, but as I said to you, it'll be interesting to see Waterford. Look, Cork and Galway, they'll be delighted with the bye. Again, like, it gives them an extra week. It also means that if they get through their game, that they're going in playing a losing quarterfinalist, and that would give both of those teams serious momentum. So don't underestimate the value of having that bye, especially in Galway's case, where they might just need to kind of fine-tune a couple of things, positioning, etc. Like,
we have to give a nod to Antrim, because I think they were going into this game as favourites against Leash, and it was so disappointing for them after having such a good league campaign, relegated back to Joe McDonagh. Like, doesn't really do them any favours, doesn't help them improve now.
No, it's cruel, because so ultimately when you're at the bottom of the mountain, you keep on climbing and you can't stop at any point to savour the view. And I suppose in Antrim's case, like, they did so much good work during the league. But again, it came down to this was ultimately the game that they needed to win. It ultimately was, at all points, going to be the most important game of the year. And now they've lost it, and now they're back down, having only been promoted 6 months earlier. It kind of gets you thinking, Marie, and with due respect to Jay, oftentimes we're critical in terms of trying to find a system that kind of best bridges the gulf between the real elite and the lesser elite teams. But so it's very hard to kind of come across a solution. I know in years gone by, they introduced these teams at the round before the quarterfinals, the two finalists in the Joe McDonagh, but that didn't do them any favours because they were getting rinsed as well. So, like, to me, just the more you think about it, the only way I can kind of see a solution to try and maintain the success that is the Joe McDonagh and also allow these teams to partake in the All-Ireland Championship is to just introduce them into a preliminary round, one-off against each other. And look, if teams can get through two rounds of them, then they're into the normal All-Ireland Championship, the quarterfinals, they have a Leinster, and they don't go through the Joe McDonagh route. But if they don't, then they can't have any excuses either, Marie. And again, unfortunately, that's the harsh reality of elite sports. There's no place for second place. And maybe the longer-term picture that GAA could help these teams in is how they can facilitate their underage and through their schools and underage setups. Because it's only when such times you get that consistent level of winning and savouring success that's under 17, under 20 level, that ultimately you'll sustain your place at elite hurling.
We will be previewing the Munster hurling final and the other hurling games later in the week. But Niall, as a Limerick man, do you think it'll be straightforward for Limerick next weekend?
I don't, really. I don't think anyone here in Limerick thinks it'll be straightforward. I suppose the hope is that our team are kind of going up through the gears. They're not at top form, they're not at top speed, but they're getting wins. And again, like in any other period of Limerick's history, to have an 8-point win over Cork coming home from Thurles, you would have bitten someone's hand off. It's a sign of the times when we're kind of picking holes in performances and maybe under par and displays from some of our marquee players. But look, I've kind of said it all along. I do think Tipperary are capable of one big win. I don't think they're capable of winning the All-Ireland. And I still do think that this Limerick team will have enough in their legs for that Tipperary team. But in the same breath, I think there is a big game in that Tipperary team there. In a lot of cases, the three All-Ireland medals. So, but again, look, I just think if Limerick hit their form, I do think they have enough for tip.
Niall Moran, mind the splinters. Thanks a million. We're going to take a break.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So it was an epic weekend of tennis even at Wimbledon over the weekend. Ashley Barty, I have written down Bartley, that's why I keep calling her that, won in three sets against Karolina Pliskova. But yesterday, Novak Djokovic beat Matteo Berrettini, and I think it was the magnitude of what Novak achieved yesterday. What's wrong, Marie? You're laughing at me there.
I'm laughing at your face trying to pronounce the names. There's so much concentration on it.
You know, you're trying so hard not to get things wrong and you still get them wrong. It's just a killer. That really, I mean, at least when you get a horse's name wrong, I can't pick you up on it. But anyway, Novak Djokovic yesterday, Conor Nolan joins us on the line. Conor, what he's achieved is incredible. And I noticed for the first time yesterday how a tennis match can swing on one game. Did it?
Yeah, hey guys. Yeah, I mean, like, it was a weird one because Berrettini started very nervously and Djokovic went up 4-1 or 5-2, and we thought, here we go, this is going to be a bit of a dud final. And he managed to claw himself back into it and win the first set, and the crowd started to get into it as well. It was pretty obvious that the Wimbledon crowd were blatantly up for Berrettini, which was funny because, again, this whole Djokovic thing that we all have, that he's just not that liked and loved compared to your Federer and your Nadal. So to see a sort of an underdog being cheered for like that in a Wimbledon final is kind of unusual. But look, as he did the usual. He reeled the guy in over the best of five format, and was obviously the deserving winner at the very end. But you're looking at every tennis match comes down to a couple of moments, but he tends to win those moments more than anybody ever. So yeah, another great performance.
I thought it was the fifth game in the fourth set. I just thought it was a phenomenal game of tennis between two men really going for it. And when Djokovic got the better of Matteo there, it was done and dusted.
Well, I feel like, yeah, you've got your Berrettini, I suppose, has a couple of windows, whereas you feel like Djokovic, if you look even back at the Roland Garros final, he went down two sets to love and was still able to claw himself back into it. Whereas you feel like Berrettini has one or two opportunities and really had to take them. And look, Berrettini served great, but he doesn't have, I suppose, the variety in the return game that Djokovic does. So Djokovic is in it a lot more service games than Berrettini is on Djokovic's. So yeah, a really good final, and Djokovic obviously moves to 20 slams along with Nadal and Federer, and is going for the calendar slam now at the US Open in September. So he's trying to do that. The first person to do it since Steffi Graf did it in 88, the first man since Laver in 69, and it'll be interesting to see if he goes to the Olympics now and tries to do the golden slam that Graf did in 88. So there's still an awful lot to play for, but I would put him as a huge favourite to go and win US Open now, and and get that career slam and go one ahead of the other two boys.
Yeah, it's set to be absolutely incredible. And he said himself afterwards that he's the most complete that he's been as a player, but the thing that he's improved most at is dealing with those pressure situations. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, that's his 30th slam final. And I think he said last night, the more experience you get, the more belief you get. And I think he just has an unbelievable amount of belief against anybody, that no matter what the situation is, he's able to find a way. He's done it again. And look, we're seeing with even Federer, like, he's 40 next month. He made the quarterfinals. He's still in the conversation. You know, Chiellini in the football last night, 37. So Djokovic is 34, and it's just changed. Like, people are able to compete at the very highest level now in their late 30s. So I think Djokovic now has his eye on the Serena Williams 24 slams, you know, the Graf 22 slams, and trying to actually be, you know, even out ahead of the women and be sort of pound for pound the most Grand Slam titles, and try and even end that conversation. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised to see him get 25, because Federer is starting to be less and less of a feature, and Nadal obviously probably has another Roland Garros in him maybe, but it looks tough for him to maybe get to that 22, 23 mark. So he's in really good shape.
He's an incredible athlete, so he is. Connor, thanks a million for taking our call. We'll have to get you back before the US Open. Marie, I think we have a closer for today's show, do we?
Yeah, we do. Our producer, Andrew O'Connor, who is married to a lovely, lovely Italian woman, has done up this great closer for her, and I think it's very fitting after an absolutely brilliant month of football. We should celebrate the Italians as we say goodbye today. So, goodbye.
Mason Mount shepherds it back to Luke Shaw. Shaw finds Kane. And Kane sweeps it wide. And it's Walker. Tip delicate ball in. A chance. Long. Shaw scores. What a sensational opening. Here's the corner. And Pickford down. And it's there. They've got the goal back. And it's Bonucci. Didn't deal with the corner. The sense that was coming, and all it took was a set piece. And the big centre back brings it to the level.
Bukayo Saka has got a pick to take. If he gets it, it goes to sudden death. If he misses, Italy are champions. And Donnarumma wins the title for Italy.
History is a dream come true. Really, it's unbelievable, but we feel some magic. We feel inside to come in Wembley and win. We are so happy.